That, of course, is the voice of Jim Post, and I'm playing that especially for producer Lise Graham's mother, who is somehow in love with Jim Post. Jim Post is a legendary figure on the folk scene here. Two legendary figures on the theater scene here in studio with me, my dear old friend, Gary Houston, an actor, director, a theater person, and Peter Guarino, who is the head of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago. You, Peter, are telling me that Gary was one of the founders of this?
Yes, Gary was back with us when we got started in 1995.
Remind me how you started.
One of the original founding members.
I don't remember how I got into it. Actually,
well, Peter's very persuasive. There's no
question. There was a number of us who were equity actors who discovered, you know, we shared a common love of Shakespeare and met at the Equity office.
When the Equity office was on Wabash, we went up and we read among ourselves. I remember one time Ned Schmidtke, who was fled to L.A. to become a movie actor, was going to he was in it. Wait a minute. Yeah. No, it wasn't in it. We were doing Othello, and we couldn't get a black actor. He was supposed to show up, so I read Othello. That was my only shot at the part. And we did Titus Andronicus, and I played Titus Andronicus, but that was with no audience. Eventually, we started having audience.
What appealed to you about this, Gary, and about joining this? You'd run into each other at auditions, and you shared an affection for Shakespeare.
I think it wasn't affection for Shakespeare as much. It was in Peter's case, I'm sure. In my case, it was a sense of being viewed as someone who didn't have any classical chops.
Hmm.
And therefore, someone who had to prove that, if not prove that I had them, at least try to acquire them. And by the experience of doing a lot of plays in the form of readings. So I think that would explain better than anything why I got involved.
That's really interesting. Peter, were there other people of similar like-minded?
I think so. I think the Shakespeare Project was a safe environment for a lot of actors who wanted to try their hand at Shakespeare and see how they would do. We started doing these theatrical readings in front of audiences, and they weren't reviewed. So you could go out and try some things and hone your skills and do it in front of an audience.
But it was also the collaborative nature of working with many actors who were very familiar with Shakespeare. You are an ardent fan of Shakespeare, you know?
Absolutely. And it was really great working. I think Gary and I worked together. We did a TV episode before we actually got together with the Shakespeare Project.
All I remember was the American Enterprise, Pullman show. But
I think it was 86. I think we did an episode of Lady Blue.
I wasn't Lady Blue as a terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that you? Was that you?
That was me
in
there too, yeah.
We were terrorists on Lady
Blue. So we were terrorists before
I got shot by Lady Blue.
Before we got involved. And then a few years later, I got a chance to direct Gary in The Taming of the Shrew.
That's right. It was he let me play Petruchio.
Gary has done, as of you, Peter, has a remarkable career in Chicago. The last time I wrote about Gary was when I wrote about Grease, which they were doing a live television broadcast of Grease. Did you watch that, Gary?
I did, and they called it immersive because that was a buzzword back then, and it means everything from environmental theater to will take you behind the scenes while the thing is going on.
Oh, so it's like American Idol or something.
Which is what they were doing, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's all it really
was.
Was
it any good?
I think, first of all, it's unrecognizable because they used songs that I don't even think, you know, the Kingston Mines show had songs that weren't on Broadway. Broadway
right.
had songs that weren't on Kingston Mines. The movie had songs that weren't on either. This had songs, I think, on none of those other versions or permutations of it. So, but that shouldn't be it. I think, no, I just didn't like it very much.
Yeah. Peter, let me ask you, not Gary or me, because I thought Grease was the most phenomenal thing in the world, and plus my father, with whom Gary worked, could get me free tickets since I was at Kingston Mines. And another, the younger sister of a friend of mine, Polly Penn, was also in the show. She was a teenager then.
15.
You remember Grease when it was here?
No, I don't remember seeing it. I wasn't here in Chicago when Gary was doing it here.
But can you think of anything, either of you, that was a bigger Chicago theatrical phenomenon than Grease?
Well, Warp was just being that it was also on Lincoln Avenue down the street. it came, was it before us or after us? I think it was after us.
I think it was after you.
And I think that was big, if for no other reason, the fact that it was in three parts, Warp 1, Warp 2, and Warp 3, called a sci-fi trilogy or something like that. And that was pretty big stuff.
Well, but John Travolta never starred in the movie of Warp. That's another thing.
And Warp never got to Broadway, whereas Grease did.
You know, and Grease got to Broadway so fast, did it not?
Well, it did, I think so, because we did it in 1971, and they opened it before Broadway. They were off Broadway at the 14th Street Theater, and I think that was 1972. So, yes, it was quick.
The great thing for Gary Houston about Warp is, about Grease is... in that initial production of Grease is where he met the love of his life, and that's
Hedda Lubin.
Probably more important than getting a big role on some kind of TV show.
Oh, sure.
But we're here to talk Shakespeare. The new season starts with Shakeshaft, which is a U.S. premiere, is it not, Peter?
That's right.
The other amazing thing about this is it's written by the former, it's not written by, a young playwright in London. It's written by the former Archbishop of Canterbury. How did that, he retired, said, yeah. Hey, I think I should become a playwright now. I've got some kind of decent pension.
We're very lucky. Dr. Rowan Williams, who was the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury, we have a very good friend on our board, Regina Schwartz, who's a professor of English literature at Northwestern, and she's very good friends with Dr. Williams. And it was actually Regina who brought the play to the Shakespeare Project, I think about a year and a half ago. And I was really intrigued by it when I read it. And then I sent it down to the Newbery, which is our Chicago home. And the Newbery is just great. We have a long history there, and it's sort of our Chicago base, if you will. And,
you have to get approval before you do something?
Well, we wanted to get a staging of it there. That's what we wanted to do. And it just so happens that the Newbery is opening a big symposium on religion in the Renaissance. And they're having an event called a symposium called The Politics of Conversion. So this play, Shakeshaft, fit perfectly in that agenda, and the performances that we're doing are co-sponsored by McGill University in Montreal, and we're also doing a performance up here at the Niles Main District Library. So,
let me ask you, before you went to the Newbery, I have to assume that you, and the whole idea of it is, you know, for instance, if I were in your group and could act, and I would say, wow, the Archbishop of Canterbury just wrote a play about Shakespeare, we'll do that. Did you read it first?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I trust that you did. I trust that you did.
I mean, Dr. Williams is a brilliant writer, and he's a great lover of Shakespeare as well. So all those things certainly played into it. But it's a wonderful play. It's a play that puts on the stage at the same time a young William Shakespeare and Edmund Campion, who would go on to be a Jesuit martyr.
Yeah.
So the play is very much about one man who's Campion, who comes back to England at great peril to tend to the Catholics who are being suppressed, and he encounters Shakespeare,
who was teaching school. These are like this takes place in the lost years.
That's correct.
There's
evidence that Shakespeare may possibly have spent time in Lancashire on the estate of a wealthy Catholic landowner, and he was hired as a teacher, because there's someone named Shakeshaft in this gentleman's will. So what William's done is he's pieced together some of this circumstantial evidence and created a kind of fantasia, if you will.
That's William's word for it.
Fantasia. Yeah, on what would have happened if these two men actually met. Shakespeare being 17 years old and Campion being 41, and the play taking place in 1581, which was the year when Campion was martyred.
It is fascinating, the whole notion. I'm talking with Peter Guarino and Gary Houston. Gary is one of the stars of this show that will take place September 16th at the Newbery Library at 10 a.m. in the morning. We'll take a short commercial break and continue on with these theater folk.
I'm so glad I don't have to cross the Mississippi, or I do believe it would break my heart.
It's the voice of Jim Post, who lives and performs with occasion, more than occasionally, in the river town of Galena. Gary Houston and Peter Guarino, actors, directors. Gary, remind me of the play I saw in your apartment where, like, there was a naked person.
Oh, Rick, that's terribly salacious.
I know, but it's etched in my mind. What was
it was salacious. it was in our friend Donna Dunlap's apartment Cornelia.
Yeah.
Across the street from Tony's Hot Dogs.
Right.
Close to Treasure Island. Well, right around the corner from Treasure Island. And we were on the third floor. We charged a quote-unquote donation, so you had to pay it in order to get in, $5 a piece, something like that, which was expensive then.
Yeah.
And we had about
Carolyn Purdy.
Purdy Gordon and Larry Hart. Boy, these are names that no one has mentioned.
This is a while ago, too.
It was Sweet Eros by Terrence McNally and Mighty Aphrodite, my play.
That's right.
And Woody Allen stole it many years later for his movie called Mighty Aphrodite. I can't believe he got away
without
with
paying
it.
You. Without paying.
And I don't know if we should go any further, but I'll tell you.
No,
we called it massage parlor theater, and we had we thought we had 26 places people could sit with overstuffed chairs and straight chairs and sofas around the room, but sometimes we got more than 26. We got 30.
I remember there was standing room only the
and,
night I was there.
David Gordon, Stuart Gordon's brother, was behind a partition with a rheostat and lighting and bringing lights up and down, practicals as we called them, practical lights. And it was a nudie show to some extent. And we served champagne and sherbet between the plays.
Don't remember that. I remember Carolyn. I remember Carolyn. Both of you have devoted your lives to local theater. It's not financially lucrative, but I've always gotten the sense from both of you, and I've known you a long time, and I've recently become very fond of Peter. It's been worth it, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what my life would be like if art wasn't part of my life. I think I'd be very unhappy. And, you know, I never really got into the business to think that, well, you know, I'm going to make millions and millions of dollars. I got into it because I really loved what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I've been very lucky to be able to continue doing it. All right. And it's absolutely been worth it.
I'm sure you feel the same way.
You know, I found Peter has got a lot of rewards and satisfaction helming a company. I tried to do that for a while, but I just found out I was a bad leader. So I think my gratification came in acting and directing.
Yeah.
Especially acting. I got away from acting in order to direct and pretty much got in my licks, I think, with some avant-garde spectacles in the 70s. But I think where I really found a lot of satisfaction was some parts, oftentimes playing real people.
Yeah.
William Blake was one, Ringlardner.
Nelson Algren
and Saul Alinsky. And I think there's, George M. Pullman.
Sure.
Yeah, so say George Pullman.
That's where I met Peter. Well, we didn't meet, but I thought we met on that. And so all of those things were very, very gratifying. Grease was part of that as well.
Of course.
Because I wanted to work with Herman at the Sun-Times. I wasn't interested in going to New York with the show. I would have had to face possible rejection if I had auditioned, but I wasn't chickening out. I just simply wanted to stay with the Sun-Times.
Who could have imagined? Well, you know, life is filled with wagers, and you bet.
Yeah,
And you can't guarantee a win, and you stick with what you love. I'm glad you both stayed here. We're going to talk with both of these gentlemen for the whole hour about Shake Shaft, which is having its U.S. premiere. It's Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. That's such a lofty title. I mean, you know, in the little playbill, it's just going to look fantastic. You know, he's written one previous play. He's also been an actor, or was an actor, for 40 years or something. So he knows the theater. And you both, really, who do you play, Gary, in this play?
Well, his name is Alexander Houghton. I thought it was Houghton, but it's Houghton. And He is, sorry, Lancashire. He has his castle in Lancashire. And this is where the action takes place, and they take in people who are trying to find some cover from the agents of the crown who are persecuting Catholics, and including the person we believe may be William Shakespeare and Edward Campion. Or Edmund or Edward?
Edmund Campion.
Edmund Campion, who was somebody who was one of the great leaders of the recusal movement. And recusal movement means you refuse to adopt the official Protestant religion of the crown. Instead, you are like a Catholic, you know,
yeah.
A secret Catholic. You know, you may know New Mexican history a little bit or Nevadan history, but there is a group of people historically called the Cryptic Jews or Crypto Jews,
mm-hmm.
who had to hide their religion when they were in that part of the American West, and for not just decades but centuries.
Wow!
This reminded me a little bit of that.
There seemed to be, and we'll get into this after in the second half hour, there seemed to be a lot of, I don't want to call this a topical show, but there seemed to be in what little, you sent me a copy of the play, and I did read it, and I thought, there are some things in this play
yes.
that really, really echo kind of loudly in
descriptions of Elizabeth, perhaps?
Yes, in these wild, crazy times in which we're living. Peter, are you in the show too?
No, I'm just directing it.
When you direct a reading, and mm-hmm. and again, I know many of you have been to productions of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago at the various lovely libraries in which they perform for free. They read from big notebooks with the show in them. How do you direct that? What are you doing with a reading?
Well, the first thing I do is I get together a really, really good group of actors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you have a good group of actors from whom to choose.
We do. I mean, we have a wonderful pool of talent here in Chicago, and we have a really wonderful cast assembled for Shake Shaft. I try to cast, when I'm directing, give the actors at least maybe 2 months with a script before
mm-hmm.
we actually start rehearsal.
Wow.
And we can go out to lunch. We can talk about the part. We can, discuss it, that kind of thing. And then when we get together really the week before we go up to do the reading, and we rehearse for 17 hours. So it all comes together really quickly once we actually meet and get on our feet. Our readings are staged, which means actors make their entrances and exits. There's some stage business. The actors perform with a book in hand, a binder.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much, the audiences generally tell us that they don't see the books after the first couple minutes.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because the actors are so committed to what they're doing, and the story is so engaging and riveting that it really it becomes very much close to a full-out performance.
How big is the cast for Shake Shaft?
We have 10 actors, and I'll mention them real quick. We've got the wonderful Lydia Berger Gray. We have Jack Kickey. We have Gary here. Peter Eli Johnson, John Kishline, Chris Landis, and Bill McGough, Kim Richard Mowry, Christopher Prentice, and Grace Smith. And they're all wonderful, and I just can't wait to get everybody in the same room to start.
You can see it, ladies and gentlemen, Saturday, September 16th at 10 a.m. at the Newberry Library. And you really should go to, we're going to talk more about the upcoming season, to ShakespeareProjectChicago.org, and you should stay tuned as we get a little commercial break and then some news. Nah, I'm no good at this. Gary just said you're really getting good at this. Well, there is no commercial break. So what should I do?
You mean that I've recorded?
What? No, we're still
we're ready.
Live. Don't worry about it.
We're ready over here if you...
Are you? Do you have an extra minute of news? A great Roger Badish. Roger, do you like Shakespeare?
I love Shakespeare. I actually taught British literature a couple of years to some of my high school students.
You taught British literature.
I'm not great at it, but it's not my background, but I love it. I actually dressed up as Shakespeare one day.
You dressed up as Shakespeare
for my
day.
Classes, yeah.
Oh, for your classes.
Not just
to
every
ride
day.
The bus. Just, yeah, the third Thursday of every month, I dress up like Shakespeare just to see what people will see. Well, thanks for saving me on that thing, Roger.
I'm going to leave the States behind me.
headed out for western land. That's the one and only Jim Post for Lise Graham's mom, his biggest, most devoted fan. I'm talking for another half hour with Peter Guarino and Gary Houston. Peter is directing and Gary is starring in the latest production, Reading. Can I call it a production, Peter?
Sure.
Again, a production of the Shakespeare Project.
But don't
Chicago.
Call me a star, because I'm not sure I'm starring in this.
All of the people in these shows are stars. That's the way I look at it. That's the way I look at it.
Featured.
It is the U.S. premiere of Rowan Williams' play Shake Shaft that had its world premiere not long ago. He wrote it after retiring, I guess is the word, as the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was a longtime actor. And the play, as I was saying in reading it, and thanks for sending it to me, Peter, there are things that the audience will turn to their friend in the audience and say, oh, my God, that's just like so-and-so. Will they not?
Absolutely. The play on one level, I think, is going to be eye-opening for a lot of people that aren't really that familiar with what was going on during the Elizabethan period.
Yeah.
When Elizabeth was excommunicated by Pope Pius V in 1570, a lot of really bad things started happening for Catholics in England. And priests were basically exposed or being called papists, people who were intent on overthrowing the queen and restoring the old religion, which was Catholicism. The Houghton Castle, for instance, which Gary mentioned, which is where the play is set, many of these castles had what were called priest holes, which were tiny little rooms where priests would take refuge when the authorities would come around and
hiding places.
Yeah. Feeding tubes that went through the mortar.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. So you had this, basically Queen Elizabeth imposed the Anglican religion, on everyone. And if you didn't attend church, the Anglican church, for instance, you were fined. People were thrown in jail. Priests, again, were sought after. And many of them left, and others bravely went underground and used disguises and all kinds of different methods to avoid capture and would find a place in a home and then secretly conduct mass with.
Now, I know that when you put on these productions that you stick around afterward to talk to people, but do you give it a frame of reference beforehand? Especially
we do.
This one seems like...
Yeah, the people are familiar with the Shakespeare Project know that there's three parts to
right.
our presentation. So a dramaturge comes in and does about a 10-minute warm-up, if you will, before the show, talking a little bit about the historical context, about the author and what was going on. And then we will perform the play. And then after the play, we have a discussion between the actors and the artists and the audience so that people can get their questions answered.
Well, this one might be particularly intense, don't you think?
I think so, too. Yes, I do. Not only that, but, it is a modern play, even though it's set in the period.
Right.
Whereas with Shakespeare, Shakespeare himself, you may actually discuss things like poetry and the use of language and how lovely it was and everything. This is set in his time and focused on his time.
Right.
Whereas
right.
Shakespeare's plays are focused on
previous,
ancient Greece or mythical
right.
this or that.
Right. Interesting.
There's been a lot of attention on young William Shakespeare in the last few years.
Well, I must tell you
and
listeners out there that, a couple of years ago when Peter was on the show, he was telling me off air about Stephen Greenblatt's A Wheel in the World and sent me a copy that I just devoured. I thought it was one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. It's about Shakespeare.
And it's about how Shakespeare became
Shakespeare. Right, yeah. And making some leaps, but it's also the narrative is so compelling. And you get a new appreciation for this guy named Shakespeare. I still can't understand how one guy could be so smart, but that's another
right.
that's another question.
And it's also interesting how so many people don't believe that Shakespeare could have been the person that I at least believe he was. Right?
Yeah.
So
do you believe it, Gary?
I don't take a stand on it. You know, we've heard about Francis Bacon as a possibility.
Sure.
Edward de Vere.
And that it had to be
Marlowe,
some rich,
in the case of some parts of the histories.
Right.
You know, that, in fact, if Frank Harris, in his one of his essays on Shakespeare, said he was comparing something of Shakespeare's with something of Marlowe's, which he found was much better, which is from after he Duke of Gloucester, who becomes Richard III, mm-hmm. murders Henry, the king. And he says in the middle of a speech, I am myself alone, which he finds is a titanic four words put together. Well, that's attributed to Shakespeare, not Marlowe.
Yeah.
And yet Frank Harris was convinced that that wasn't Shakespeare, that it was something from, you know, by Marlowe. Right.
Conspiracy
so
theories.
We have all kinds of theories about the authorship and everything.
Well,
and
I'm
waiting for someone to say that there's really Martians who came down and came down
well,
and wrote
maybe,
the play.
Maybe the president might think that's something right, like yeah. that. Have you, in your, we started this conversation talking about how Gary Houston got involved in the Shakespeare Project at its inception to sort of learn more about Shakespeare and that classic kind of thing. Has it been beneficial over the years to you, Gary? Has it made you a better actor or
I think
given
is,
you a deeper understanding?
Well, here's something I learned, and I learned from watching the show on with Patrick Stewart and other actors, Ian McClellan with John Barton. I think this was on public television back in the 80s or 90s or something like that. One of these famous people said one of the biggest mistakes an actor could make with Shakespeare speeches, long ones, was to generalize, meaning if you have a speech that obviously begins in anger, the bad tendency is to say, well, you have to say the whole thing angrily, the whole speech.
Right, right, right.
But every line is written with a different meaning, and you should actually follow the course of not only the meaning, but the emotion that would attend it all the way through. Well, that's a lesson for actors who do contemporary
anything,
plays, too.
Sure. Sure.
And it sounds really basic.
Yeah, it does.
But Shakespeare forces you, I think, more or less to temper your speech to whatever you are saying at the time. Because you have to figure out what he means. Contemporary speeches, you don't have to figure it out. But you can naturally do it. Yeah. But Shakespeare makes you think anew about this problem of not generalizing, or avoiding generalization of an emotion.
How many shows have you been in over the years of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago?
I don't know anymore because I did most of my stuff in the 90s with them. I think there must have been
How did you get involved in this one, in Shake Shift?
I came back to it because Peter wanted me to do King John earlier this year.
That's the reason, isn't it,
yeah.
Peter?
Yeah.
And so I'm returning and I'm seeing all these people I've never met before.
Wow. All the youngsters, the young Shakespeare.
No, a lot of them are old, but not as old as me. Mm-hmm. Right? Or I'm not sure.
Well, one of the things, and Peter, you're always telling me about the sort of lack. Shakespeare has fallen out of fashion in, you know, sort of contemporary so-called higher education. That they don't, Gary's looking like, really, Rick? It's true, isn't it?
It is true. And it's unfortunately a troubling event that we hope we can do something about. I think a lot of it really relies on teachers and them really making a commitment and being excited and passionate about Shakespeare. Because if you're really not passionate about something, you're not going to be a good teacher at it. And I think sometimes teachers didn't have good teachers themselves. They kind of wanted to get through it.
Yeah.
You know, Shakespeare is no longer required English in most English curriculums.
And like 80% of curriculum, which is
just optional.
Astonishing to me.
And one of the things that we do in our education outreach program at the Shakespeare Project is we help facilitate the English-speaking Union's National Shakespeare Competition, which is great. It's a national competition each year for high school students. Gary was one of the judges here at the Chicago Finals this past year. And we're really trying to get more high schools in the Chicago area to participate in this. We had about 20-some high schools participate last year, which is a really low number considering how many high schools there are in the Chicago area. And if there are any English teachers, drama teachers, forensic teachers listening to the program, You can get more information on the competition by emailing chicago@esuus.org, which is the English-speaking union, and get your school involved, hold your own competition, and then send a representative to the Chicago Regionals, which will be held at Roosevelt University next February. And the winner of the Chicago competition then gets to go to New York and compete at Lincoln Center against over 50 other high school students from across the country for the national championship.
Well, I have a question, Peter. Does this mean that the high schools that participate actually do include Shakespeare in the curriculum?
That's a great question. They may or they may not. It may be something that the teacher is able to organize on their own, irrespective of the But the teachers have to spend extra time after school coaching and watching the students do work on their audition pieces. So there's some extra work involved. But it's wonderful to see these students, you know, do the pieces and really take ownership for the language. And it's something that they'll take with them, the poise that they develop, the confidence that they develop through the competition. It's just great to see. And considering there's so many things that can occupy high school age kids' minds these days and all various different kinds of competition, competition focused on Shakespeare, I think, is a really great thing.
Well, any competitions focused on language is a valuable competition. We've got to take one quick break, then we'll come back, tell you a little bit more. I hope I've seduced you into going at Saturday at 10 a.m. to the Newberry Library, Saturday, September 16th, for the U.S. premiere of Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, of his play, his second play, Shakeshaft, starring, featuring, whatever you want to say, the great Gary Houston. We'll be back in 2 minutes and tell you about the rest of the season, because it is... I want to know how you pick. I mean, you obviously have them in rotation, so you're not going to do Julius Caesar every year, but you pick them. You pick Shakespeare's plays for a specific reason and to form a kind of year-long narrative. We'll be right back. Jim Post, you'll hear an entire song shortly, but I still have a few minutes left with Peter Guarino, who is what's your title, the artistic director of the Shakespeare Project Chicago. That's the website too, shakespeareprojectchicago.org. And Gary Houston, my old dear friend, used to be a colleague of my dad's many years ago, and I've seen him in all manner of shows over the years, starting with, I think, Grease was the first one. When Grease started, it had to be. I was only about 17. That was the first Gary Houston show I saw. And Gary Houston and Polly Penn together. This is the 23rd season of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago. Saturday, September 16th, 10 a.m. at the Newberry Library, you will see the U.S. premiere of Rowan Williams' play, Shakeshaft. Rowan Williams, Mr. Williams, Dr. Williams, is the former Archbishop of Canterbury, and the play's good. I read it over the weekend, and it's very, very provocative, and I will say it is, even though it's set in 15, 18, 16, 15 something, it's very 81. Top 81, 18, 16. That's a long time ago.
And just a quick note, we are doing a performance on the 15th, I'm sorry, let's see, on the 15th at the Niles Main District Library.
So of Shakeshaft.
Of Shakeshaft,
yes.
So that was formerly the Niles Public Library. It's now the Niles Main District Library. And anyone wants to come to that, please pre-register, and you can do that.
All you have to do, just go to the website, because it has the season mapped out. In late October, you're doing As You Like It. In January, Coriolanus. Then I know Shakespeare didn't write Women Beware Women.
Though that's Thomas Middleton.
It's a very good title, Women Beware Women. And then Much Ado About Nothing ends the season in May. When you put together a season, Peter, what's the narrative you want to get?
Well, that's one of the great joys about, you know, being an artistic director is being able to, you know, look over a long view in terms of what you want to achieve with an audience over many years. And we do have a kind of a rotation. So we do each play about once every 10 years in the Shakespeare's canon. And then when I took over in 2010, I wanted to put some focus on Shakespeare's contemporaries. So each season we do a play by one of his contemporaries.
Right.
And the nice thing about that, it's allowed us to actually do a fairly deep introspective look at Thomas Middleton. We're doing his play, Women Beware Women, this February, directed by Kelly Lynn Hogan and Michelle Shoup. This past season, we did a play called The Changeling, which was directed by Steve Scott. And that was a play that Middleton co-wrote with William Rowley. We did a play of his called The Revenger's Tragedy a couple of years ago. And this is very important. So an audience is able to actually get a little bit deeper into what Shakespeare's contemporaries actually look like. And Middleton was a very important playwright because there's very good evidence that he actually was a collaborator with Shakespeare on plays like Measure for Measure,
really?
All's Well That Ends Well, the Scottish play.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
And so it's very, very important to see his contributions to those plays as well.
You guys should get in touch. I just wrote about today in the paper the resurrection of Theater on the Lake, that amazing building. It is a beautiful space. My God.
Have they refurbished it?
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember the old field house.
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah. I remember it, too. There were, like, you'd see a show with rats. You were sharing the audience with rats. Yes, they've refurbished it to the tune of $6 million. Wow. It's a restaurant event space, which is how you would pay, and it is going to be a year-round operation. And that would be an amazing place for you guys to just do some show.
Sounds great.
So take a look at that.
Well, one of the lake facilities, one of the places we did do readings at was the Burger
Park Mansion.
Burger Park
Oh,
Mansion,
yeah, sure, right. Sure.
And that's where I think most of mine were. And then eventually we branched out to the Harold Washington Library. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore, do
no.
we? But then there was another park district.
We were at the Lincoln Park Conservatory.
That's right.
For
yeah.
Right. Yep. Well, you do branch out. You folks should go to the website ShakespeareProjectChicago.org, not just to see about the show in Niles on the 15th, but the show at the Newbury Library on Saturday, September 16th at 10 a.m. in the morning. Get a cup of coffee and go see Just people go, what are you doing? What are you doing Saturday morning? Well, you know, the former Archbishop of Canterbury wrote a play, and I want to see if he's any good. I want to see if he's like the new David Mamet or something. Things are going well. I mean, you would always could use more money and donations and all that jazz, but 23 years is a long run. And
yeah.
I just think of the many hundreds, not thousands of people you've turned on to Shakespeare.
Right, and our whole model is totally different because we are entirely supported by people who believe in what we do, which is providing professional performances of Shakespeare free to the public, right? And we do that because individuals believe in our mission. We also get some support from the venues, our library venues, which I'll mention real quickly. I mentioned we're at the Niles Main District Library on Friday evenings. We have performances on Saturday. At the Newbury and in the afternoon at the Wilmette Public Library. On Sundays, we're at the Highland Park Public Library. On Monday evenings, we're in Lincolnshire at the Vernon Area Public Library. And on Tuesday evenings, we're in Mount Prospect. So we have six venues now. We bring the show to each of those venues, and we have wonderful audiences, generally almost
You must have
capacity.
Really loyal audiences. You must have people who've come for 23 years.
I believe that's so. Yeah. You know, there's something that ought to be said. There are a lot of advantages to a full production of any playwright's plays.
Sure.
Certainly Shakespeare's, which is why I believe Chicago Shakespeare is such a big, important institution in Chicago now. But there is something to be said for readings. The actors don't come out in full costume. They try to do a contemporary approximation of a character's costume.
Mm-hmm.
They hold books. There's no real scenery to speak of except what the room has to offer to begin with. However, all of these things kind of free the audience from the distraction of the settings of an actual production. And I think in a way they concentrate on the words more.
Yeah, because there's no noise. There are no sound effects. There's none of that. You two guys, Gary, it is great to see you. Gary Houston is a featured performer, featured star of the many stars in Shake Shaft. And Peter Guarino runs the Shakespeare Project of Chicago and is directing this U.S. premiere of the former Archbishop. I'll never shake that. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, his second play. He was an actor. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. It's great to see you, and great to see both of you, and knock him dead.
Thanks,
Rick. Walk over on that.
Thanks,
Rick.
Thanks for having us on.
Oh, it's always, you know, you're like a regular now, Peter. Peter's been in here with his kid. I've watched his kid grow up. Gary, come back, or we'll have lunch or something. That's more my style. Stay tuned. I'm going to play some music, and you're going to hear from someone who has charted the comedic history of Playboy magazine, which is considerable when you really want to think about it, and Playboy clubs. Dick Gregory, who recently died. Playboy is the one who put Dick Gregory on a stage for a white audience for the first time.
At the club?
Huh?
At the club?
Yeah.